London dropped its dignity.
Yeah.
So has France and Germany.
Yeah.
All hands are dancing to a raggedy melody full of originality.
Sing it, though.
Hello and welcome to yesterday's Chip Paper, a fortnightly-ish podcast where we look at bizarre and strange and macabre stories from historic newspapers. I am Jim.
And I'm Violet. And we're a couple of amateur reporters? Kind of reporters. And amateur
kind
researchers who are based on opposite sides of the Atlantic. I am in London and Jim is in New York. And every couple of weeks, we get together to tell each other about some stories that we've found in historic newspaper archives.
And I'd like to point out that this is episode 13, you still haven't got the intro right.
Oh, I know. I'll get it one day.
Yeah. So, at the top, fortnightly, if this is the first time that you're listening to it and you're not from England, fortnightly means 2 weeks. And also, if you've never listened before, I'm sitting in a wardrobe.
And I'm just standing in a room, so
yeah, I can't do that. I have no soft furnishings. I've gone minimalist, which means that I live in an echo chamber, both figuratively and literally. So it is your turn to take me through a story that you found this week.
So the story that I found this week is quite exciting because this is a story of global headline making people. In as much as that was really exciting, it also made it quite hard to research because there was so much contradiction in the various reports. So you'd find one report and you go, oh, okay, so that's what happened. And then you'd find another one from a couple of days later that just like completely contradicted everything that had said. So it took a lot longer than I initially thought and it ended up being quite a can of worms.
Okay.
But this is the story of Jesse Maud Chubby Beveridge, who...
What?
Chubby is in air quotes. That's what everyone knew her as. So Jesse Maud Beveridge was born in 1902 in Western Australia. She was the daughter of an English banker and his wife. And at 18, she married a well-known journalist in Australia called Keith Miller. They didn't seem to have a particularly good relationship. She wasn't working. They had a baby which died in its infancy. And soon after that, Jessie told Keith that she wanted to travel and see the world. And he was initially not really so keen on this idea, but she did eventually go. She left for London and took up rooms in Baker Street.
That's quite a desirable address.
It is. My mum used to live on Baker Street.
Is your mum Chubby Beveridge?
This is not the story of my mum.
Just checking out.
Who was not born in 1902. But, anyway, that was a nice little connection. And it was at a party in London in 1927 that Chubby first met Bill Lancaster. Bill was an Englishman who'd emigrated to Australia as a teenager. He joined the Australian Army and then the Australian Flying Corps during World War I before remaining in London after the war with the Royal Air Force. And at the time he and Chubby met, he was 29 and he'd just transferred from pilot officer to the RAF Reserve. So when they were at this party, Bill told Chubby of a dream that he'd always had to return to Australia by flying solo in an Avro Avian, which is a tiny light aircraft, the likes of which had never been used for such a long journey. And despite her having absolutely zero experience of flying before this encounter at a party, Chubby managed to convince Bill to take her with him. So this is like one of those tiny little airplanes that just has the two seats, one for the navigator, one for the pilot.
Yes. We'll post a picture of an Avro Avian on Facebook.
I'll post a picture of an Avro Avian with Bill and Chubby in it.
Chubby.
To make it even better.
I'm wondering if Chubby understands what traveling the world is, because there isn't a return flight, which is where we are now.
So she managed to convince him, reportedly partly through her direct manner. Make of that what you will. That was what one report said. And partly through her offer to help him fund this trip. And so they went. And they departed from Croydon on the 14th of October 1927 en route to Darwin. And during the trip, Bill taught Chubby how to fly and navigate the plane. And there are loads, I found loads and loads of really nice stories that were actually written by Chubby in the newspapers, where she described all of the different stops that they made along the journey and how she'd just received all of the trunks of clothing that she'd had sent over from Australia, only to have to then fit everything that she wanted to keep into a tiny suitcase for the trip.
So, was she wealthy, Chubby?
Yeah. Well, she was the daughter of a banker, so I'm presuming she was wealthy.
Oh, sorry, you did say that. So upper middle class, sort of.
Yeah, basically. I think that's probably how she managed to get the rooms on Baker Street.
Yeah, and then helped to raise money for the flight. If I was wealthy, I would probably buy my way out of the surname, the nickname Chubby.
Well, Bill loved this. I think it was Bill who actually coined the pet name for her, so he's to blame.
Okay. And were they romantically interested in this? Romantically interested?
It was very complicated, but all will be revealed.
Okay.
5 months later, they touched down in Darwin, but the journey was slightly overshadowed by the fact that they'd been overtaken at Singapore by Bert Hinkler. So he was technically the first man to make the solo flight from England to Australia in a very similar plane. And he was all over the headlines just before they arrived. And so...
Oh, that's so annoying.
It was a little bit annoying, but they didn't really set out to set any records anyway. They just did it because Bill had always wanted to do it.
Fair enough.
But yeah, so it was also quite complex, like, wading through all of the stuff about Bert with, like, the same plane and everything. However, this is where the Australian newspapers came in handy because they were all over it, because obviously Chubby was Australian and Bill was practically Australian. And Chubby was the first woman to complete the journey, not to mention the fact that she'd actually flown some of the way. So they basically became instant celebrities.
Oh, cool.
And also all over the papers was the fact that people noticed that the pair were also each other's biggest fans.
Ooh. He did call her Chubby, though.
I mean, you know. but Bill's father also noticed this. And he strongly warned his son against any kind of relationship, as not only was Chubby still married to Keith, the Australian journalist.
I remember Keith.
But Bill had a wife and two daughters back in London.
Right, okay.
But Bill was like, you know what? I'm going to file for divorce. But his wife wouldn't grant it. Keith, however, filed for divorce against Chubby on the grounds of abandonment, and she obviously just accepted.
Yes, that's fair.
So, in 1928, so the next year, Chubby and Bill moved to the States, apparently having been offered roles in a Hollywood film that fell through.
Well, that's why I moved here.
Damn it! Just keeps happening! did you have a ticker tape parade in New York?
No, I'm sitting in a cupboard.
Well, I mean, Chubby and Bill did, but, you know.
Oh, did they? Oh, man.
Yeah, welcomed by a ticker tape parade in New York before they settled in Florida. Unfortunately, the Depression hit them hard, as most of the flying companies were in financial trouble. But despite this, they continued to keep up appearances, and they mingled with high society, as was reported in a lot of the papers, going to parties and things. Chubby just about managed to keep regular work, as a female aviator was still somewhat of a novelty. At one point, she went missing during a fairly straightforward flight from Havana to Miami, and she was accused of doing it on purpose as a publicity stunt. She denied this, but the headlines were basically exclusively hers for the few days that she was gone before she was found on a tiny island. So they're in a lot of financial difficulty, but Chubby's still making headlines. And it was around this point that an American named Charles Hayden Clark approached the couple and asked to write a book about them. They agreed, and he moved in with them to their home in Miami. Bill was still finding it pretty tough to keep any sort of regular living, He lost one job after crashing a plane in Trinidad and then tried selling auto parts. But at one point, their funds were so low that Chubby is reported in the Taunton Courier as saying that Captain Lancaster and Mr. Clark foraged in the neighbouring gardens for food in the shape of tame rabbits and chickens.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, they're not good. In 1932, after 4 years of basically being destitute, Bill went south of the border for a job with Latin American Airlines, leaving Hayden, the writer, and Chubby in their house in Miami. And a report in the Canberra Times from 1995 suggests that Hayden wasn't actually a writer at all, and that he never wrote a single word of the biography that he was meant to be writing.
So he just wanted the free accommodation?
Yeah, it kind of sounds like that. But while Bill was away, Hayden and Chubby grew closer. Ooh. And yeah, they fell in love, and they sent a telegram to Bill, or a letter, I'm not sure which, telling him that they intended to marry. And he immediately started the journey back to Miami, sending a telegram that read, "Hold on to your horses, kids. Insist on being the best man."
What?
Yeah, which that was my reaction as well. But, you know, on 20th of April, 1932, Bill arrived back to their Florida home. And Bill, Chubby, and Hayden reportedly had a heated argument over dinner. Eventually, they retired to bed, and Bill told Chubby to lock the door to her room. He said so that Hayden couldn't sneak in to discuss their wedding plans. Bill and Hayden were sleeping together in a separate room.
What? Are they romantically interested?
Yeah, actually, Bill was like, "Hold your horses, I need to tell Hayden I love him." But, no, they're not.
Oh.
In short. Oh. I believe they had separate beds in the same room.
Oh, okay.
In the early hours of the 21st of April, a gunshot rang out through the house. Hayden was dead, and Bill was arrested. On the 12th of August, the Canberra Times ran the story with the headline, "Lancaster Trial." Captain Lancaster, with a voice steady and emotional, described what he called the suicide of Clark at the resumption of his trial today. He returned a calm no to the point-blank question by his counsel as to whether he killed Clark. "I was awakened by a bang and thought it was a window. I called, 'What is that, Hayden?' I heard a gurgling noise from Clark's bed. Leaping from the bed, I found blood streaming from Clark's face. A pistol was lying beside him. The last thing I heard Hayden say was, 'Bill, you're the whitest man I ever met.'"
What a burn to leave him on.
The Monroe News Star on the 3rd of August 1932 said that Houston, Miami attorney, testified today at the murder trial of Captain W.N. Lancaster that the British aviator tried to persuade him to say he owned a revolver found under the body of Hayden Clark, young American writer and fiancé of Mrs. J.M. Keith Miller, who was shot at her home last April 21st.
What is interesting there is that Chubby, as we're calling her, she's mm-hmm. divorced at this point, right?
Yes.
And yet she still has her first husband's first name.
I'm not certain, because I did find the divorce certificate. I'm not certain because the reports came a lot earlier than the actual certificate did.
Oh, so she wasn't yet divorced.
Technically, she might have still been married.
Right, okay. Because also, like, no offense to anyone listening, but Keith, it's not a...
Apparently, he was a really well-known journalist, but I couldn't find any of his work. Online, at least, but...
Maybe he was called, like, Fatty or something.
Yeah, maybe. I see a connection here. Yeah. So, Houston was the first witness of the day in the prosecution's attempt to prove the former British Army flyer killed the youth because of jealousy over the affections of Mrs. Keith Miller, a native of Australia who has engaged in numerous flying adventures with the captain. The witness also testified Lancaster called him to Mrs. Keith Miller's home about 3 a.m. April 21st, advising him of the shooting. He said Lancaster gave him two notes with the explanation Clark wrote them just before he was found fatally wounded in a room he shared with the flyer. They were couched in terms of despondency and mentioned contemplation of suicide. Houston said Lancaster and Mrs. Keith Miller suggested destroying them, but he dissuaded them. These were the notes Lancaster later admitted he forged with hopes of removing any suspicion that might be cast at Mrs. Keith Miller.
That backfired.
And not at himself either, but at Chubby. So, loads of former flying colleagues and people who had worked with Bill came forward to testify to his character. But probably the one person he needed most on his side gave a pretty damning report of their last encounter. In a quotation that was widely reported, but which I've taken from Border Watch South Australia from the 9th of August, right. Just because I like the name. M.G. Tannerell, president of the Latin American Airways, so this would have been his boss. So it says, Tankrell, who is now in jail on a charge of having impersonated a naval officer, said that Lancaster declared in a hotel at Nogales, Arizona, I might have said that wrong, but anyway, that he had heard all about the affair between Clark and Mrs. Miller. I am going back east to get rid of that man, Lancaster is alleged to have said. Tankrell said that weeks previously to this threat, Lancaster had told a British flying colleague that he was afraid Clark had double-crossed him, and if he had, he would fix him. I've seen hundreds of dead men, and one more will not make any difference, Lancaster is alleged to have said.
I guess maybe he would have if he was flying during the First World War.
That doesn't
seem like a topic to joke about anymore.
But this was Bill's boss at the time, and okay, he's in jail for impersonating a naval officer, which is actually a detail that you should remember because it will be important later.
Okay.
So the trial continued, as reported in the Sedalia Democrat on the 12th of August, with the headline, Bullet Pierced Skull of Clark Before the Jury. Captain Lancaster, accused of his murder, peered intensely at it. So, using the bullet-pierced skull of Hayden Clark and the pistol that ended his life to illustrate his testimony.
Stop talking.
Go on.
The skull of the dead man was brought into the courtroom.
Yes. Approximately, so it wasn't April, May, June, July, 4 months later.
What?
I couldn't understand this either. I don't know.
That's not long enough for this.
No, they've... I know. I have no idea. I honestly couldn't work this bit out at all.
They've cut a head off. Off. And then cleaned it.
Go on.
Where was this?
So this is in Miami, Florida.
Ah.
Yeah. So okay. I can't work that out. where did I get up to?
The skull.
Memorable part.
Yeah.
So using the bullet-pierced skull of Hayden Clark and the pistol that ended his life to illustrate his testimony, Arthur H. Hamilton, criminologist of Auburn, New York, told a jury today he was absolutely convinced Clark committed suicide. There is not a scintilla of evidence here to show that Clark was murdered, Hamilton testified. Dr. Hamilton was a chemical and ballistics expert, as well as a criminologist with 47 years of experience. And he went on to describe how the fact that the hair wasn't singed suggested that the barrel had been pressed against the skull, and to further detail how the way the bullet had lodged in the skull made him come to the conclusion that it was self-inflicted. So, on Wikipedia, it suggested that Hamilton may have had a sketchy past, but I couldn't check the source that it cited, And I read through the courtroom transcript where the prosecution examined him for ages, like looking at, asking him questions to try and dig up stuff on his character for ages. And they just didn't seem to make any headway. Like, he just seemed like a perfectly normal criminologist, but as far as I can tell. I mean,
normal criminologist who has to be 70 years old.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's a lot of experience.
Yeah.
So I'm not, like, I'm not suggesting that Wikipedia's wrong, but I just couldn't personally verify that. And, I mean, Lancaster's lawyer was meant to be one of the best, well, he was one of the best in the country at the time, and allegedly he never lost a single case in his entire career. So he was either the best lawyer ever known, or there is a chance that he had some sketchy connections, but that's pure speculation.
Do you know what else it is? A pretty significant spoiler for how this goes.
Well, on the stand, Chubby gave quite a remarkable statement, as reported in the Scotsman on the 4th of August.
I, Chubby, do solemnly swear.
So, she
I, was... Chubby Keith.
Chubby Keith Miller. on speaking about Hayden the writer, no, on spe- sorry, on speaking about Bill, she said that he seemed very depressed and told her that he had planned to commit suicide by means of an aeroplane accident so that she would benefit by the insurance money. But he'd later learned that the insurance company had failed and therefore he had abandoned his plan. She also said that she and Hayden had talked about suicide, especially after Hayden became ill and they couldn't afford to get him proper treatment.
This sounds like a terrible place to live. I mean, I'm sure the 1920s were a very, very difficult place for a lot of people, a difficult time for a lot of people in America, but this is a house full of people just talking about the means by suicide. Which they'll commit suicide. And then finding out that the insurance company's failed, so they just will have to find other means.
They just have to go scrounge another rabbit from next door.
Also, if I'll say this, if you're scrounging for people's pet rabbits in gardens, sell the gun.
That's not a bad something. Point. Yeah. The Taunton Courier on the 10th of August said that when Captain Lancaster left for his 6 weeks tour of the West in search of flying engagements, he sent her small sums of money occasionally, which he knew he could not afford. On these remittances, she and Mr. Clark eked out their existence together. She thought of their committing suicide together and said to Mr. Clark, Hayden, if we could only end it all together. He replied, yes, I wish we could. She admitted, however, that they frequently got drunk on home brew. And they are reported as continuing to go to a lot of parties on the money that Lancaster sent them. So, basically, Lancaster had a motive. It was his gun. He wrote fake suicide notes, but there was this counter-evidence from the criminologist. These weird suicide quotations from Chubby, and a whole host of people testifying to Bill's good character. The trial lasted for 14 days. The jury deliberated for just 5 hours before coming back with their decision of not guilty. But that wasn't the end of the courtroom for Bill. And this is the part of the story that I did not at all expect to find, and which is really isn't that well documented online anywhere.
Okay.
You see, while they'd been searching the house in Miami after the murder, they came across some very unusual documents, as reported in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle on the 22nd of April, 1932. So that's the day after the murder.
Okay.
Meantime, Department of Justice agents scanned a quantity of correspondence found at the Keith Miller home, referring to a proposal to smuggle alien Chinese from Mexico into the United States by airplane and boat. The woman flyer told Hawthorne last night that Lancaster was under contract with a smuggling company.
This is why we need to build a wall.
Stop those airplanes. Ah, shit.
Make Bill Lancaster pay for it.
So Bill completely denied this story that Chubby stated. As the Reading Times reported on 25th of April, he said that he was under contract, Lancaster told the federal officers, to fly for a concern which, he learned after signing the contract, planned to smuggle Chinese aliens and their gold from Mexico into the United States by a plane boat route. Lancaster said he withdrew from the contract as soon as he learned the nature of it, and the agents said Lancaster gave them every assistance in their investigation of the narcotic smuggling angle. Strangely enough, at this point, Bill and Chubby were both arrested for having entered the country illegally.
Yeah. When? So, at the start of all this?
Yeah. See, oh, this is... Yeah. So Chubby was in the same prison as Bill for being an illegal alien. Because they were like, right. Hang on a second, you're Australian. What are you doing here? And then they were like, hang on a second, you're British, to Bill. And what are you doing here? So they were like, we don't want these undesirables here. So they just put them both in jail. Reportedly, after an unidentified person lodged a complaint and Chubby was unable to post the £200 bail. So, yeah, they were just both in prison. The Fresno Bee on the 4th of August 1932 reported that Lancaster is charged specifically with being in the country illegally, but is also accused in documents on file at the department of having smuggled aliens into the country and plotting to bring in more. Four other men and Mrs. Jesse Keith Miller are named in the records as having been his associate in the alleged ring of smugglers. One of the men is a Miami lawyer who is reported to be the payoff man. No formal charge has been brought against him. Two of the men are in jail on charges of wearing Navy uniforms and posing as officers in the Navy Air Corps. Another has been convicted twice of smuggling. So that's...
See, his boss from earlier.
Presumably his boss. It's got to be his boss. So the Labor Department investigators have reported that the group smuggled aliens and drugs through the Florida Keys and the Florida East Coast. Lancaster and some of his associates are also accused of planning to smuggle Chinese from Mexico to California. But this was given up after Clark was killed and Lancaster was arrested.
So hang on, can I... Just,
do you want to recap?
This got
you need to chill out.
So, all right. So, Chubby married, kid died. Chubby goes to London, meets Bill Lancaster. Lancaster flies her in a little plane back to Australia.
Yep.
Then they make the news, and a Hollywood person calls them, and they go to America and have a ticker tape parade. Then it all falls through, and they live in squalor. A guy who's a biographer comes to live with them. Bill goes off doing whatever. Biographer starts sleeping with Chubby, which is what we were calling her. And then they're still going to parties and Bill is sending money. They all talk about suicide all the time.
Yeah, and then, party.
And then Hayden Clark shoots himself. Jesus. They go to court. Bill Lancaster found innocent, but while they're searching all that, they find that Bill is somehow shipping Mexican children, no, Chinese people from Mexico with gold to Florida.
Yeah, and narcotics, don't forget those.
And narcotics, don't forget those. And here we are. Oh, no, and then they get put in prison for being illegal
immigrants.
Themselves.
Yep.
Right. I think the warning signs were there. At the outset, if you look at it as instead of Bill and Chubby flying to Australia, if you look at it as Bill stealing Chubby.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he was already ferrying an illegal immigrant around for quite a long time.
Exactly.
So on 22nd of September, that was also a great roundup, I've got to say.
Thanks. I am listening.
The Indiana Gazette reported that it was an Inspector Doak who had been leading this investigation for over a year. Evidence implicating the two flyers in alleged alien smuggling activities was forwarded by the Labor Department to Florida authorities in connection with Lancaster's trial and acquittal for the murder of Hayden Clark, a youthful writer. Doak stated, "This evidence was never used," he added. "Some of the evidence in this smuggling ring is the most terrible I have ever seen. Parts of it are not fit to print. I have a stack of papers a foot high dealing with the many angles to this case. Concerning the Lancaster and Keith Miller angle, Doak declared, "We have not decided yet whether to bring Captain Lancaster and Mrs. Miller to trial or whether to deport them and let this angle of the case drop." Well,
dunno.
Bill took what was dubbed by the press. So they're out on bail now at this point, I'm pretty sure. What was dubbed by the press a secret trip to Washington. And soon enough, he and Chubby were both back to the UK, but by ocean liner this time, and separate ocean liners at that. On the 24th of August, 1932...
Separate ocean liners.
The Western Daily Press reported, "On board the eastbound Cunard liner Sathia, when it arrived at Queenstown yesterday, was Captain William Lancaster, the British airman, who was acquitted by a Florida jury on the charge of killing Mr. Hayden Clark. He said he was glad to be returning to England following an absence of 4 years. He was anxious to meet his father, and his chief concern was to escape the attention of pressmen on arrival at Liverpool. Captain Lancaster had nothing to say concerning his trial, beyond that American reports had been greatly exaggerated. He said he intended to resume flying and would possibly attempt another long-distance flight, but he had not yet decided on the route."
What's insane to me is that I didn't realise that this had all taken place in 4 years.
Yeah, and they've gone from, like, the heights of, like, you know, going on a joy trip in a tiny plane for 5 months and then just, like, crashed through. It's like they've crashed through, like, levels of badness from, like, the heights of everything being great down to, like, the worst it could possibly be.
It's Icarus.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that... Ah, oh, I wish I'd thought of that.
we can call this episode, "It's Icarus, I wish I'd thought of that."
So he's back in England. He was alone. He was penniless. He was married to a woman who didn't want him.
Of course, and he's still married.
He's still married, and he wanted a woman who wouldn't marry him. So it was all very depressing for him. So... in 1933, he decided to try and break the speed record for a flight from the UK to South Africa. And by all reports, he was not in a good frame of mind for the duration of this flight and the lead up to it. Like, as soon as he set off, he got lost straight off the bat and took hours to reach his first stop.
He got lost.
He honestly, like, there was no way he was going to be breaking any records on this flight. It was madness.
I've never achieved any speed records for long distance air flight or anything. But isn't it just south?
Well, yeah, I don't think it was as complex as he seemed to find it. Right. On the 24th of April, a French airman described in the Dundee Evening Telegraph how Bill had finally arrived at Regan in Algeria, and he was completely exhausted, and the airman said his aeroplane was refueled and he rested for 3 hours, but refused any food. When he was ready to resume his flight, there was no moon and a strong northwest wind was blowing. M. Borrell, the head of the Trans-Saharan Company at Regan, told Captain Lancaster it was madness to take off, when he would not be able to see the day beacons on the Trans-Saharan motor track, and when he had no lighting on his instrument board for steering a compass course.
Oh, okay. All right.
Captain Lancaster...
I was kind of being a dick. Sorry.
Captain Lancaster said he would manage with some matches before M. Borrell gave him a pocket electric torch. Captain Lancaster made a very bad takeoff, and that was the last seen of him.
Ever?
Well, he went missing, and he was making headlines across the world, and loads of people were speculating as to whether it was, like, his final kind of suicidal journey, as he'd always talked about, or whether he was guilty, and he was just so guilt-ridden that he couldn't possibly, you know, face living a normal life anymore. But Chubby walked the streets of London tirelessly to try and get someone to fund her search for him. But no one did, strangely enough. I mean, there were search parties out looking for him, but they wouldn't allow her to go, by the sounds of things.
Right.
So yeah, he was just gone. And in his will, though he was still married, Bill left his entire property to Chubby, which totaled £170, which even in 1933 was not that much.
Is it not?
Well, not really. If that's like everything he owns, and his family were apparently not so happy about that. But.
Yeah, I imagine.
And then slowly years passed and people just, well, I mean, obviously people didn't forget about him, but the newspapers just stopped reporting because there was no news. Until one day, on the 12th of February 1962, French military found the crash site along with Bill's mummified corpse and some handwritten notes.
Oh, no!
To my darling Chubby and my darling mother. The final one was written on the 20th of April 1933, exactly 1 year, bar a day, after the death of Hayden. It said, "So the beginning of the eighth day has dawned. It is still cool. I have no water. I am waiting patiently. Come soon, please. Fever wrecked me last night. Hope you get my full log. Bill." In 1995, the Canberra Times reported that on hearing of his death nearly 30 years later, Chubby was now Mrs. Pugh, a housewife to a company director with whom she lived in Berkshire.
She's still called Chubby?
No, she doesn't go by that name anymore. Mm. When questioned by a reporter, she replied, "I was young and foolish then, and I want to forget the episode."
Well, tough. Here we are.
And that was the last report I found.
That's really reminiscent of the end of Amelia Earhart, who I think was 1937 she went missing.
Yeah, that's true.
And they recently identified her by a femur, I think.
I didn't know she'd been identified.
Yeah, they found
a
skeleton. Last year, they found a skeleton on the island. They found remains on the island that they assumed that she crashed near. And they found, I think years ago, they found some of her belongings, like a mirror or something. And then they identified her because she apparently was like, I don't know if she was oddly proportioned or if she was just oddly tall, but she had a really long femur and they identified it recently by those. Anyway,
I didn't realise that had happened, but...
Yeah, but it's quite similar, I mean, you know, except without... Yeah. Bill obviously left really tragic and sad clues.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't hard to tell who it was.
No. That's messed up. That's a messed up story.
Yeah, and when I first found it, I was like, oh, that's quite a good story about... Because I was reading about their flight and how he'd, like, taught her how to fly. She became, like, really well-known also as an aviatrix when she was in the States and she, like, competed in all these, like, tournaments and things.
I would say, I'm not necessarily fond of sort of feminine terms for when they could just be neutral, like aviator or actor.
Yeah,
or
I agree, actually.
But aviatrix is a cool word. It's the only one that's, like, objectively much cooler than the male equivalent.
But yeah, it was then, like, looking further into the story, I then found out that he'd, like, crashed. And then I found out about the murder, and I was like, oh my god, like, that's a full story right there. But then all of the extra stuff about them being put in prison for being illegal aliens and, like, all of the, like, smuggling and everything, I was just like, it was insane. And all of that came from the newspapers. I didn't find any of the smuggling or the immigration stuff.
And it's all in 5 years.
Yeah. What an insane half decade.
I know, yeah. I mean, and you think, like, what would have happened had Chubby and Bill never met at that party? It's a good story.
What did you find this week?
I found a letter and a poem, and both are bonkers.
that's the way we like it.
But for different reasons.
Okay.
I'm going to do the poem first, because it's nuts. I'm just reading it back, it's so stupid. It's from the Longreach Leader from Queensland from the 30th of March 1951. It's from Trove.
Oh, what a very Australian episode we're having.
This is going to be a very Australian poem.
Okay. Why I'm already laughing.
I don't know. I don't know if what I just said is xenophobic, because...
It's okay, I'm very judgmental of my own country.
This poem goes... A little fly crawled up the wall. He had no ma or pa at all. He had no comb to comb his hair. But he doesn't care. He's got no hair.
That's great. I love that poem.
That's by Riddle Me Ree.
Riddle Me Ree.
He doesn't
care.
That's
great. Was he actually someone, was that someone sending in something to the paper, or did they actually write for it?
I think this is probably a child.
Just checking.
Actually,
Sign that kid up. I like him.
I've been too generous to Riddle Me Ree because it actually doesn't say, but he doesn't care. It just says, he had no comb to comb his hair, but doesn't care. He's got no hair. That's how it ends. And they ran out of space in the line as well, so hair is like dropped down a line. And then for my letter, this is an England that doesn't... Well, this is a British Isles that doesn't exist anymore, thankfully. This is the Pall Mall Gazette, 6th of August 1901, the British newspaper archive. And to give you an idea of the readership of the Pall Mall Gazette, this is above a letter about how somebody believes the cavalry to be using the wrong horses. So, dear sir, may I say a word apropos of the hunting affray near Cairo on July 3rd? So obviously that happened in Egypt. It would be interesting to know if the reeking reckless hero of the chase considers himself entitled to ride into a gentleman's walled garden and to refuse to quit it when requested. A pack of foxhounds, this is bonkers. A pack of foxhounds came into my lawn one day in the south of Ireland and were led by the huntsman, my hall door being open, over all the bedrooms in my house in their search for the fox, right? Led by the huntsman in a man's house.
To look for a fox.
The poor fox, having previously entered the house by the same door, was taken by me into the kitchen. I locked that door, and the fox and I sat by the fire together while he ate a plate of meat. As one no redress for such an intrusion into one's house by sportsmen, truly yours, an imported fox.
I love that. That guy's a hero.
The guy's sitting in his locked kitchen like, we won't let them get you.
My only response to that was going to be, lock your door. Yep. But now I'm like, actually, you know what? Sit with your fox in your kitchen.
A fox terrified by the pursuit of hounds. And this guy's like, quick, in here! And it runs into the kitchen. And he locks the door. He's like, I've got some spam. And then they just sit there chatting and playing canasta or whatever.
That was not the ending I was expecting.
Me neither. When I started reading it and they led foxhounds into the house, I was like, that's pretty bad behaviour, guys.
But I was like, yeah, that's a pretty good letter, Jim.
But then when it's him just with the fox. Oh, no, he's not in here.
So did they remain close or?
I don't know. I like to hope so. I like to hope that they embarked on a long distance flight to Australia.
In one of those little planes.
Became embroiled in some people smuggling. Yeah. Well, that is everything for this week, I think.
That is everything from me.
Thank you very much, everybody, for listening. If you get the chance, please do pop over to iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you consume your podcasts and just rate and review us, because it really helps.
And we're also on Facebook and Twitter. They're both at Paper Podcast.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more bonkers stories from the newspapers. And as always, all of the archives that we use in the recording of this podcast will be available in the show notes.
Playing us out are Al Jolson and Sophie Taylor with the
only song we could afford.
Thanks to the Free Music Archive.
Thank you for
little hint there.
Okay. All right, thanks. Bye.